from 1935 until 1962, missing only 6 days upon the passing of FDR. Meanwhile, she was commanding a veritable beehive of social activity. A year's worth of guests at the White House in 1939 tallied 4,729 who came to a meal, that's 13 a day, 9,211 who came to tea, 25 a day, and 1.3 million and change who came through to tour the staterooms. I'm hoping she didn't also have to provide that teeming horde with cheese and crackers. I know she didn't personally feed all those guests, but just imagine having that many strangers in your dining room year in and year out. You'd better have a substantial supply of gumption ready to hand. She often cited her exceptional work ethic as a great source of comfort in her life. At least I have never known what it was to be bored or to have time hang heavily on my hands. During the second term of FDR's presidency, Eleanor began to work with the American Youth Congress, hoping to learn from them how to improve the lives of the younger generation, particularly those from less fortunate backgrounds. Unfortunately, she recounted learning much more about the unscrupulous methods employed by the aspiring communists in the group. Apparently, these young strategists were getting an early start in politics, as they would demur to debate certain subjects, causing delays until the other members would tire out and go home. Once enough of the opposition had left, the communists would hold and carry the vote. Mrs. Roosevelt found these shenanigans very annoying at the time, but their lessons would come to serve her well when she eventually had to deal with the exact same tactics on the floor of the United Nations. With her personable and down-to-earth daily column, Eleanor Roosevelt gave women of the day a sense of empowerment when they were able to learn the First Lady's opinion on any number of subjects. She became an instrumental voice in the struggle to right the imbalance felt by both women and minorities in our country. While touring England, she was inspired by women performing every manner of job that one was accustomed to see being performed by men. I saw girls learning how to service every kind of truck and motor car and to drive every type of vehicle. I even saw girls in gun crews. I visited factories in which women did every kind of work. Eleanor was moved by the myriad women from all walks of life working side by side for the greater good of their mother England, just as the men were fighting as one for the same cause. Her reason for pointing this up was that the British Isles were considered to be very class-conscious, but here in wartime, those distinctions fell away, and the citizenry became welded together by the war into a closely knit community. From her purview, she saw a new set of group values emerge. This is a nice observation on her part, one that I can certainly understand and get behind. A sense of collective nationalism brought on by the mutual jeopardy of having guns and bombs aimed at one's entire country. The thing is, it makes me wonder what has become of our own population's ability to stick together. We seem to be beyond a time when another military power can hold us at gunpoint with sheer brute force, and so have we complacently lost interest in what all the other Americans are up to since we're not at war? It would seem that we still are looking down the barrel of destruction. It's just not perhaps as bluntly presented as a German tank. Water shortages, the exhaustion of fossil fuels, not to mention the subsequent pollution and global warming, the neglect of our own agricultural communities, the insatiable appetites of our mining companies, all these seem fully lethal as well. Maybe they won't kill us as succinctly as the Blitz, but we have come to know that they will kill us. And I'm afraid it'll be in a much more permanent way than the carnage of a gun battle. Cities can be rebuilt with much greater ease than ecosystems. Like many rational human beings, Eleanor Roosevelt had an instinctive abhorrence of war. And yet she didn't hesitate to get all up in its grill. This was back before it was all long distance, war by remote control. Eleanor joined the Red Cross and took to visiting the soldiers in field hospitals who were wounded in both body and psyche. Exhausted from walking miles of corridors and witnessing every color of injury and trauma, she wrote emotionally, "But that was nothing in comparison with the horrible consciousness of waste and feeling of resentment that burned within me as I wondered why men could not sit down around a table and settle their differences before an infinite number of the youth of many nations had to suffer." Her answer may reside hidden right within her question, in the noun men. Human beings are complex. We're complicated as shit. But I can't help but think that planting a few Eleanor Roosevelts in seats of power might help the scales of justice, held by a lady, after all, tip back toward not killing people. Women can be assholes too, surely. I realize that war is more than just the men and their Freudian passion for shooting at one another with their penises. It is also about the billions of dollars being funneled into their pocketbooks. Women have those accessories as well. Once FDR had to dance the jig of equivocation that is the American presidency, meaning he had to play both sides of the fence enough to keep his majority, Eleanor began to make waves, what with her common sense acceptance of all people, regardless of race, political affiliation, or genital inventory. To put things in perspective, there was a bill sponsored by a couple of Democratic senators from Colorado and New York, called the Costigan-Wagner Bill, that was simply trying to cut down on the number of lynchings taking place in the South. This was 1934. Edwin Hubble, with his swell telescope, showed in a photograph as many galaxies as the Milky Way has visible stars. George S. Kaufman and Moss Hart's Merrily We Roll Along opened on Broadway. Katharine Hepburn won an Oscar for Morning Glory at the age of 27, and some uppity Yankee senators thought there should be fewer mob-driven murders of black fellows, the sort wherein they were hanged with a rope by the neck until they were dead. Now get this, FDR wouldn't back the bill. He was afraid of losing the Southern congressional delegations when he needed their votes to support his legislation. That's how fucked up it is to be president. You can seem as decent a chap as FDR, and yet you can't get behind the suggestion that we make lynching illegal. Eleanor lobbied for the bill, so white Southerners didn't like her. Black people, on the other hand, did like her. Go figure. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, boogeyman fear politics saw Franklin sign his Executive Order 9066, a directive born of hysteria that ended up imprisoning Japanese Americans in internment camps. About 120,000 Americans of Japanese descent were incarcerated for 2 to 3 years. That was in the 1940s, gang. Eleanor was very opposed to this racist, cowardly act on the part of our nation, for which she was again widely ostracized. Her famous uncle, whom you might recall from Chapter 5, was a Roosevelt with a decidedly less savory attitude toward national violence. I obviously revere much of what he had to offer, but I cannot get behind his opinion that a great country was one that picked fights. Methinks that Uncle Theodore could have used a strong dose of his niece's prudence when it came to dealing with his fellow earthlings. I'm referring to the lady who penned this. "Nothing we learn in this world is ever wasted, and I have come to the conclusion that practically nothing we do ever stands by itself. If it is good, it will serve some good purpose in the future. If it is evil, it may haunt us and handicap our efforts in unimagined ways." This American champion took some common sense, a healthy dollop of elbow grease, and some natural compassion, and set for us a shining example of how we can begin to settle our differences around a table, instead of looking into the business end of a gun. She worked and worked until her working parts quit on her. I hate to think where we would be today without all the good she did for each and every one of us. Chapter 8. The Maverick. Tom Laughlin. Tom Laughlin. May he rest in peace. You may recognize him better in the slight guise of his heroic alter ego, Billy Jack. If not, please gently toss this book aside, hie ye to your nearest video store, if you're listening to this in the 1980s, or I guess whichever Netflix or Amazon channel is providing you with feature-length film treats these days, and watch Billy Jack, a movie that may be little known now, but was at the time, 1971, both a cultural revolution and the highest-grossing independent film of all time, a record it still holds. You'll likely want to devour it at least thrice, so please notify anyone who might be relying upon you to deliver their medication or perhaps pick them up from school, scouts, or 4-H if they're especially lucky. My own obsession began 25 years ago. I was in college at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 1989 when I first met Darren Kritz. Although he was enrolled in the class behind mine, he was a couple years my senior, having bounced between majors for a minute before landing upon theater, with a focus in directing. His appearance upon our first meeting bears reporting. He was extremely buff, with a wild, shoulder-length mane of black curls festooned with little plastic star beads, framing handsome, hawkish features. Neck entwined in an intimidatingly thick rope of Mardi Gras beads that would have made the My Little Pony hidden inside Mr. T green with envy. He shaved his body hair with clippers, which made the extreme definition of his musculature stand out in all the real estate visible under his flannel shirt, with the sleeves and collar cut off. His legs were equally exposed in tattered cut-off jeans before they disappeared into a pair of old-fashioned cowboy boots that Darren had spray-painted gold. He was, in short, a self-made psychedelic superhero. Darren was one of the initial pillars of the Defiant Theater, the Chicago company comprised of my most invaluable college friends, who inculcated in me the sense of counterculture that would come to define my artistic life. Among the moments of whimsy in which Darren draped me were some powerfully enjoyable sessions of hallucinating and giggling in the harem-like cave of an apartment he shared with Bobby Goliath Tate, another estimable teahead, and, of course, a reverential screening of Billy Jack. One of the most popular features in any visit to Darren's place was the tactile art experience known as Grandma's Gina. Although you can sadly never know the wonder of this sexual petting, let me walk you through it vicariously as best I can. Generally, before one was ready to comprehend this delight born of Darren's fecund, puckish imagination, one wanted to put on a buzz of some sort. Fortunately, the living room that served as the gallery for this masterpiece also housed his roommate's 8-foot bong, which rendered just such a mood elevation handily achievable. Once suitably baked, the initiate would next sit in the cushioned chair beneath which the objet d'art resided. At this point, a fellow stoner, or docent, would retrieve the large glass bowl filled with a mass of bread dough, into which an upsettingly realistic rendition of a woman's genitalia had been shaped. The bowl would be placed in the lap of the participant, who would then, with eyes closed, feel the crusty orifice with his or her fingers. Sometimes a few drops of water would be sprinkled upon it before fondling, upping the verisimilitude. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Grandma's Gina. During my colorful years in Chicago theater, I was inspired by a great many women and men, eccentric iconoclasts who marched quite charismatically to the beat of their own strange drums. But Darren was one of the first to show me how a person could fly a flag that was extremely freakish and still command the respect of professionals in the world of theater. Thanks to his inspiration, I was able to make a great many fashion choices of my own that my dad would describe only as squirrely, but they nonetheless allowed me to feel like I was announcing to the world that the particular brand of entertainment I had to proffer was redolent of substance and mirth. Whether or not it was his intention, Darren made of me a lifelong Billy Jack adherent. When I arrived in L.A. in the late 90s, my newly discovered best friend, Pat Roberts, was also a fan, and together we couldn't get enough of the film. The internet showed up, and I found Tom Laughlin's website and learned of the politics and philosophy he'd been espousing all along. I then set out to learn everything I could about him. A Midwestern boy who played football at both Wisconsin and Marquette, Tom Laughlin was bitten by the theater bug after taking in a production of A Streetcar Named Desire. He met the love of his life, Dolores Taylor, while attending the University of South Dakota with her. The pair ended up in Los Angeles, where Tom began to work steadily, landing his first leading role in Robert Altman's The Delinquents. This followed his on-screen debut on the television program Climax, which was also known as Climax Mystery Theater, and was not remotely as prurient as its title. Apologies. He worked on other films as an actor and a director, leading to the first appearance of his character Billy Jack in the 1967 film Born Losers, directed by as well as starring Laughlin. Considered a box office hit, Born Losers paved the way for the sort of sequel, Billy Jack, which brings us to the meat of the matter. Much like our former president and star of Chapter 5, Theodore Roosevelt, Billy Jack makes some statements, both overtly and indirectly, that can be confusing to an audience. First of all, it must be stated that the title character is, in the modern parlance, awesome. Billy Jack is a half-breed Navajo Indian, a recent veteran of the Vietnam War, ex-Green Beret, as well as a master of Hapkido, a Korean martial art. When he intuits an impending fight, he slips off his boots and socks. Billy Jack also possesses a supernatural ability to sense danger and wrongdoing, a sort of spidey sense. To top it off, he lives in a cave, but his clothes are always clean, and he might show up on a horse, on a motorcycle, or in his Jeep, wearing a full suit of denim and his iconic Rez hat. So badass. His heart, the film instructs us, is very much in the right place, as he is a disciple of peace and love, living under the tutelage of the local tribe's shaman or medicine man on the reservation. His apparent romantic partner, Jean Roberts, played by his real-life wife, Dolores Taylor, runs the Freedom School outside of town with an openly hippie agenda promoting nonviolence and an open-minded approach to living. No drugs, everyone had to carry his own load, and everyone had to get turned on by creating something. Anything, whether it be weaving a blanket, making a film, or doing a painting. When the evil, racist, white townspeople threaten violence, Jean and the kids at the school enjoy the Robin Hood-flavored protection of Billy Jack, who is fully on board with their pacifist teachings, but as he says in the film, Jean and the kids at the school tell me that I'm supposed to control my violent temper. I try. I really try. Though when I see this, I just go berserk. At this point, Billy Jack beats the piss out of the white towny bullies with some devastating Hapkido moves. This turns out to be more of the rule than the exception. Since Billy Jack can't control the rage he feels as the result of society's injustices, the film ends up a very violent paean to nonviolence. I've witnessed a good deal of criticism focused on the inconsistencies in Billy Jack, which I have no interest in debating. All I know is that millions of people, including your author, have found themselves profoundly moved by the film's core message, that the evils of society are pervasive enough to drive a person to fight, even though he knows he shouldn't. Things are bad, and something must be done to foment a change. Billy Jack, the man, warts and all, shoulders this burden for all of us, which is why, at the end of the film, as he's hauled away in a police car and hundreds of citizens lining the road raise a single fist in solidarity with him, I raise my fist as well. I'll be the first to claim an ignorance in my ability to coldly analyze the film's foibles, because I'm too busy being moved by the hero's plight. Perhaps this is because, regardless of any missteps on the part of Tom Laughlin, he was at least doing some goddamn thing about it. His Billy Jack delivers the truth with such a measured pace and undeniable sincerity, I don't give a shit if the story is confusing. This man versus his fellow man, and this man versus himself, happens to be some material I can sink my teeth into. And so it's not that I forgive the other parts of the film so much as I just don't notice them. When I first saw the film, I was about 98% naivete, newly arrived out in the world from the small conservative town I'd grown up in. For the first time, I was living smack dab among the people on the receiving end of racism and sexism and homophobia. Here was a fellow in a film willing to kick the rich white bad guy right upside his face when the bad guy and his thugs, because the bad guy was a chicken shit, had him cornered. It doesn't take a lot of arithmetic to comprehend why I would have found that pretty goddamn swell, regardless of Leonard Maltin's admonitions. An attribute in Billy Jack, I think, that might have also held true for Tom Laughlin was a stubborn adherence to his own solitary path, including a distrust of authority and the establishment, which ultimately is thought to have undermined his career. When Warner Brothers released Billy Jack, Laughlin was extremely underwhelmed with their strategy, and sure enough, the film foundered out of the gate. He sued the studio to reclaim the film, which he then re-released on his own. In a stroke of brilliance fueled by his unwavering conviction, Tom Laughlin single-handedly forged the technique of releasing a film nationwide all at once. A wide release, bolstered by TV advertisements planted during local news broadcasts. Such a move had not been previously dared. This gutsy gambit, combined with a thirst for social change in America's younger generation, turned Laughlin's film into a box office juggernaut, making it, as mentioned, the highest-grossing independent film of all time, after adjusting for inflation. He must have been doing something right. Here's the thing, or at least here's a thing. People have vastly differing tastes. People also have vastly disparate levels of discernment. If you look at the numbers, you would have to assume that the McDonald's factory beef burger sandwich is the most delicious sandwich. In truth, it's pretty easy to understand that, in fact, it's simply the easiest choice for a lot of consumers. If there was a fast food joint selling a Reuben sandwich for the price of a Big Mac, we might see some different stats. I used to judge people for their lazy choices, which in effect was me merely judging myself for having the capacity to treat my body so poorly as to eat the burger sandwich of laziness. I believe we all have the capacity for such mediocrity, which is why those motherfuckers are making so much money off of us. So I have learned to refrain from judging my fellow humans in their choices, or at least do my best to refrain. I've certainly improved considerably, but I'm sure there will always be room for more bettering since I am, after all, human, as was Tom Laughlin. I like the way Roger Ebert put it in the Chicago Sun-Times. Laughlin and Taylor surface so rarely because their movies are personal ventures, financed in unorthodox ways and employing the kind of communal chance-taking that Hollywood finds terrifying. The chances that they take sometimes create flaws in their films, but flaws that suggest they were trying to do too much, never too little. There's not much better praise for a person in my book than that his or her heart was in the right place and the utmost of gumption was employed. No matter what anybody says to me about the films of Tom Laughlin, I will never cease to raise my fist as One Tin Soldier, the film's theme song by Coven, kicks into the chorus. Tom Laughlin would have occupied a place in this book no matter what, but an amazing set of opportunities gave me a personal connection to Tom and his family that makes this chapter even dearer to me. It began in March of 2013 when I had the extreme pleasure of appearing vocally as a guest on The Treatment, the venerable NPR show about the film business hosted by uber cineast Elvis Mitchell. Elvis nearly made me mist up with gratitude at the simple attention he had paid to much of my acting work in films that are usually much too obscure to be noticed by professional film buffs. Among the details he had gleaned was an awareness of my devotion to Billy Jack. When we had finished the interview and were saying our brotherly so longs, he mentioned that he was responsible for programming screenings at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and would I like to host a screening of Billy Jack? Suffice it to say, I answered with enthusiasm. I had never seen Billy Jack projected on a big screen, and so I was rather beside myself with excitement. Shortly before the screening, we received word backstage that Tom Laughlin's son, Frank, would be in attendance, as well as actress Julie Webb, who played the troubled teenager Barbara in the film. Now, suddenly, things took a strange shift for me, as it hadn't remotely occurred to me that Laughlin's family might be around, let alone any of the actors from the film, despite the fact that I had actually worked with one for a day in the Patrick Swayze-Melanie Griffith romp Forever Lulu. It was shooting at the storied Hollywood watering hole Bordner's, where I was as pleased as punch to be squaring off with another of my life's heroes, Mr. Swayze. In between takes of the role I essayed, Man at Bordner's, I was chatting with another of the bar patrons, a cute, rather elfin fellow, who in the course of things mentioned that his name was Beans Morocco. Well, if you were as sweaty for Billy Jack as myself, you would have immediately recognized that name from the credits, in his hilarious work with Howard Hessman and the improv players from the film's Freedom School. Comprised mainly of San Francisco-based troupe The Committee, the group hilariously commandeers a couple of sequences in the film with improvised comedy scenes. Beans Morocco plays the cute, rather elfin fellow with the hat. He seemed somewhat surprised at being spotted from his work in Billy Jack, which was nothing short of sacrilege to me. I at least got Patrick Swayze to agree with me that Billy Jack was worthy of a young man's adulation. You best believe there was also a great deal of roadhouse worship happening, not to mention Red Dawn and Point Break. The first AD was not on board, however, when every time he would call roll cameras, I would answer with, Wolverines! At the LACMA screening, with Elvis Mitchell, however, I was nothing short of flabbergasted that these vestiges of real life were invading my own personal Billy Jack fantasy. I was still so provincial in my comprehension of show business that I was utterly gut-punched when I met Frank Laughlin after the screening with his lovely daughter Jessica, and he mentioned that his mom and dad, Dolores and Tom, would have loved to attend if they'd only known about it. Frank and I struck up a friendship, and he and Jessica came to see Megan and me in our stage production of Annapurna, a great two-hander by Char White. We were loosely planning an occasion for me to meet his dad, between all the traveling I'd been doing for work, when Tom unexpectedly fell ill and passed away. I was devastated to have missed my opportunity to shake the hand of the man who had brought me so much inspiration, but at the same time I was very touched when his kids invited me to the funeral. Pat Roberts and I drove up to Malibu together, as we had so many times before, heading to the beach or to deliver furniture in my old 59 Ford flatbed truck. This time, the atmosphere in the car was weighted with a strange combination of excitement and somber reverence. We arrived at Our Lady of Malibu Catholic Church and found parking. It was immediately strange as we walked up and into the church, and a few people began to recognize me from Parks and Recreation as I greeted Frank and his two sisters, Teresa and Christina. I was rather embarrassed at their generosity in allowing me, a relative stranger, to attend this private event in the midst of their grief. Pat and I sat in the very back of the congregation to the extreme house right. My mind was roiling to keep up, even as my heart was vacillating with conflicting emotions. One, I was titillated to be at the funeral of my hero. Pat agreed. Two, I was ashamed of my titillation, which felt somehow cheap in the face of the reality of our surroundings. Pat agreed. Three, the ceremony began with Tom's widow, Dolores, being helped into a front pew. Suffering from the onset of Alzheimer's, she was still beautiful, with the stately air of a woman who had accomplished a great deal while saying little. The priest kicked things off with a reverential welcome, and I was aghast as it slowly dawned on me that there was to be no flaming pyre? No sacrificial bighorn sheep or grizzly bear? There won't be any trumpets blowin' come the judgment day? What the fuck? Didn't these people know whom it was we were burying today? At this point, I caught myself, extremely mortified at the power of my selfishness. Of course these people knew. These people belonged to Tom Laughlin, and he belonged to them. I was the egotistical asshole who had been graciously allowed by these people to attend this solemn occasion with my asshole friend. Pat agreed. Like true modern Americans, we wanted this man's funeral to be somehow about us and our superficial experience of him. Fortunately, we caught ourselves in time to arrest our descent to the nadir of good taste toward which we were plummeting. I know how a Catholic Mass goes, having grown up reciting it. I find it pretty mundane, so I continued to be displeased that Tom Laughlin was going to be sent off to glory with a mere Catholic service. Then his granddaughters, Jessica, Ellery, and Lily, ascended the pulpit to deliver the readings from the Gospels, and things began to calm down a bit in my asshole alarm centers. Here were beautiful young ladies timorously delivering ancient poetry in ceremonial honor of their deceased patriarch. This was more like it. Jessica eased us into the doctrine with a combination Bible verse, popular rock song by the Byrds, which got some black-stockinged toes tapping and girdled hips swaying. Mine. She chanted, "A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing," etc. You know how it goes. It holds up. The Byrds knew what they were about. Ellery said things like, "In my father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. And whither I go, ye know, and the way ye know." Now this I could also wrap my head around. This succinctly chosen passage from the book of John is an example of when the Bible works best for me. That is, when it can be easily applied metaphorically to our real tangible lives. The older I get and the more I pay attention, life's messages seem to reiterate. We're all the same. We're all in this together. Interestingly, sitting there in church, I thought of Tom Laughlin's impact on my life, which made me think of John Lennon, who penned, "I am he as you are he, as you are me, and we are all together." Lily picked up the scriptural baton with, "Do not be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love each other. Anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates a brother or sister is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. The beat, it goes on." Like any such function, baptisms, weddings, a few particularly memorable key parties, this funeral had my mind swimming with existential questions, as well as an examination of my own personal scorecard. How was I doing as a husband, a son, a sibling, a friend, an uncle, and so forth? I quickly switched from being disappointed at the lack of fireworks in Our Lady of Malibu to being moved by the sincerity of the service and the privilege of being invited to sit in remembrance and celebration of an astonishing man. That's when the bagpipes fired up. The player, in full dress, launched into a few selections that brought wetness to even the most insensitive eyes in the house. "Abide with Me," "The Minstrel Boy," "The Wearing of the Green," and finally, "Danny Boy." I had wanted pageantry in this observance. Now this was something like. Once the family made their recessional, Pat and I drifted outside to discuss the rich experience and what assholes we were. The congregation was invited next door to the multipurpose room, where a more informal celebration was about to go down. I spoke briefly with each of the three children, Frank, Teresa, and Chrissy, and they convinced me to stay, despite my embarrassment at feeling like an outsider. I'm so glad I did, because Act Two of the afternoon contained much more of the flavor I'd been hoping for. Frank started things off by thanking us all for being there, and then using the word fuck, which immediately let us know that misbehavior was welcome. He went on to liken his childhood, favorably, to being raised by wolves. With the comforting demeanor of a good father, as well as the oldest child, Frank thanked all the appropriate people for putting together this event and went on to share some anecdotes about his folks. The most indelible story I heard later from Frank was about the way Tom and Dolores reclaimed Billy Jack from Richard Zanuck Jr., who was running 20th Century Fox at the time. As Frank tells it, Zanuck was deeply involved in CREEP, or the Committee to Re-elect the President, Richard Nixon. There is a line in Billy Jack, delivered by Teresa, no less, comparing Nixon's actions to those of Hitler, which of course could not remain in a film coming from Zanuck's studio. Since Tom had approval of, or final cut, on the film, Zanuck had to secretly plot to cut the offensive dialogue. Unfortunately for his machinations, a secretary in his office notified Tom and Dolores that this was happening. The Laughlin duo neatly ran over to the sound studio where the film was being mixed and kidnapped the many reels of sound tape, which they then held for ransom. Zanuck had the film reels, but Tom had the sound, without which the film was merely an unreleasable silent film art project. Zanuck was notified by Tom that he needed to let Tom buy back the film, which only served to make Zanuck laugh. Tom told him that for every day he refused to sell the film back to Tom, Tom would erase a reel of sound. Presumably, Zanuck laughed again until Tom sent over a reel of blank magstripe. Zanuck absolutely flipped out and sent the reel down to the lab to be analyzed, only to receive confirmation that it had in fact been wiped. The plan worked, and Zanuck allowed Tom to orchestrate the following sale by Warner Brothers. Frank spoke with a grudging respect for his dad's methods. Although things didn't always go his way, you had to hand it to Tom Laughlin for sticking up for the things he felt were right. Teresa spoke next, emotionally, laughing about the way her father used to challenge studio executives to beat her in tennis or arm wrestling to settle lawsuits and contractual disputes. A side story, if you'll permit me. In 2014, I had the pleasure of screening Billy Jack a second time in New York City at the IFC Center down on 6th Avenue, and Teresa was able to attend with me. She is the only one of the three kids who plays a prominent role in the film, playing one of the brighter, more outspoken kids at the Freedom School. Frank doubled his dad in motorcycle shots. Christina had just been born months earlier. I had probably seen the film 10 times before the Internet Movie Database, IMDb, made it possible to discern that she was actually the daughter of Tom and Dolores. Pat Roberts and I had an LP of songs from the film, upon which Teresa had a couple of tunes, and so we were very big fans of her music as well. When we discovered that she was also the daughter of the filmmakers, she achieved a status in our household previously reserved only for the likes of Meatloaf or Dusty Springfield. Watching the film, then, next to Teresa, who was embarrassed about this art thing she had done with her parents, was very humanizing. Seeing the film through her eyes gave me such a different perspective, which made me appreciate her entire family with a profound new understanding. That they made these films together only served to redouble my respect for the Laughlin Taylors, using the tools at their disposal, karate chops included, to communicate a message of love to the world. But back to Malibu in that December of 2013. Chrissy spoke last, and although she's the baby in the family, she was by no means the least. She told us that her dad always said that everybody has a voice, that everybody has a message of their own. They just needed to find that message and share it with the world. Tom was crazy for books. He read voraciously and encouraged his kids and everyone around him to do the same. At this point, some items were passed around the room. A bowl of paper strips and a box of envelopes, of which we were all encouraged to partake. Chrissy explained that the strips of paper were her dad's favorite quotes, torn from their books. He would always make the kids stop whatever they were doing and pay attention to whichever given quote had caught his fancy, and those quotes, with their attendant meanings, stuck with the kids. She wanted his quotes distributed so that her dad could have one last shot at disseminating the wisdom that had guided him. The envelopes were self-addressed, stamped, letter-size envelopes, all set to be mailed back to Chrissy. She asked us to use them if and when we had accomplished a dream, if we would then write down the accomplishment and send it to her. She said they were a way to give each of us a reminder that life is short, that inspiration is precious, and that living life fully and unafraid is probably the only thing that matters. Tom accomplished some amazing things in his life when he charged forward bravely with purpose. If that could inspire others, including herself, what a gift it would be. If folks wrote back and the family could keep those envelopes for his grandkids and their grandkids beyond, what a poignant legacy it could be. She finished up with an Oliver Wendell Holmes quote that she found as a bookmark in the prayer book of Tom's father, as she was sorting out his things. "It is faith in something and enthusiasm for something that makes a life worth looking at." I found each of the siblings' offerings to be very moving, each in its own regard. The creativity of Christina's dispersed quotes in her empty pre-stamped envelopes I found particularly moving, as though her dad's spirit was truly moving through her and into us. I have had a very lucky year since attending Tom's funeral, but nothing has felt appropriate to write to her about until now, finishing this chapter. I believe I'll write to her about it, this chapter in this book, with which I hope, among other objectives, to engender mirth and spread the message of love among all my brothers and all my sisters. That seems an awfully sincere thing to say without a joke at the end, but I'm going to let it fly. Chapter 9. The Farmer. Wendell Berry. Good gracious. For me, the fact that you are now listening to a chapter on Wendell Berry is quite momentous. If you are about to be new to Mr. Berry's work, let me tell you right to your ear holes that you are in for a treat. Not a treat like ice cream or some other confection, a much more substantial treat, perhaps constructed cleverly of leather or hickory or copper, just like you want a barn, and someone is going to help you build it, and then that person is going to tell you how one might prosper from the use of a barn in your life. You can't know going in that it's not the barn itself, but rather the building of it and its cumulative use that are the real prizes. That kind of treat. Those of you who already know him, which it's been said is to love him, will understand just from where I'm shooting in this effort. Chances are that many of you listeners are still with me here because you have perhaps enjoyed the show Parks and Recreation, or for a much smaller group, my woodworking portfolio, and I have managed to seduce you sufficiently with descriptions of George Washington's teeth and the ship-caulking prowess of Frederick Douglass to get you this far into this particular tome. Now, as long as anyone is listening, I will holler about Wendell Berry. If you are inspired by nothing else in this, my sophomoric effort, for Pete's sake, please read his works and then pass them on. His well of common sense is deep enough to slake all our thirst. With considered sips of perspicacity that are cool, crisp, and ever so refreshing to the palate. Because I am such a student and adherent of Wendell Berry's writing, this chapter, and hopefully this entire book, will contain much less hyperbole than I would sophomorically like to apply to it. Wendell, if you have so run out of useful things to do as to be incongruously listening to this, perhaps on some period headphones, I must warn you to prepare yourself to endure some compliments. But out of the respect for economy that I am very slowly learning from your own work, I will do my best to refrain from over-egging the pudding. Wendell Berry is the greatest writer ever to have sharpened a pencil. Dang it, that was not a good start. But you're stuck with me, such as I am, so let's just press on with best intentions. In 1995, I was working as an understudy and a makeup artist on the Steppenwolf Theater production of Buried Child, Sam Shepard's masterpiece of a play with a late great character actor named Leo Burmester in the role of Bradley. Leo had grown up in Kentucky and was an absolute sweetheart as well as a substantial talent. Because of our similarly rural upbringings and I suppose a shared proclivity for playing beefy, sensitive types who might be as comfortable wielding a darning needle as a broadsword, Leo took a shine to me. Upon the show's closing, he gave me my first Wendell Berry, a book of collected stories entitled Fidelity. I am literally tearing up a little as I read this, for a few reasons. One, with gratitude that Leo saw in me a budding initiate who would possibly flower in the sunlight of Berry's words. Two, with remorse that Leo passed away in 2007, before I had the chance to tell him what a profound impact his gift had exacted upon my life. And three, with relish for the impact itself, which simply moves me to tears. which is why I'm doing my level best to pass along the gift of that influence to you, the listener, whom both Leo and I would have undoubtedly described as better looking than us. I read the stories in fidelity and was simply gobsmacked at, sure, their beauty and humor and emotional specificity, okay, but what really made me sit down abruptly upon my fanny was that I recognized my own family and my own town in these tales. The small community of families, made up of characters of every stripe, simultaneously called to mind the inhabitants of my own youth and delighted me with new players as well, ones I had not yet discerned in my travels. These first five stories ran the gamut, from stomach-churning drama to staunch familial loyalty to easy raillery between friends and neighbors. The simplicity with which the journey in making it home resolves itself never fails to fill me with a warm flood of emotion. But it was the story, Fidelity, of which I was most enamored. It concerns a young farmer's decision to kidnap his dying father from a Louisville hospital, so that he may expire in the presence of love, with dignity. I wrote to Mr. Berry to request his permission for the right to adapt this story to stage or screen, I cared not which. His charming reply gently explained his disinterest in countenancing any such adaptation of his work. Because the whole of his body of fiction, 10 novels, 5 collections of short stories to date, exists in the same setting and is peopled by the same genealogies across some 100 years or so, he considered it, and he still does, a work in progress. Now that I've read the entire canon through more than once, and some of it more than thrice, this makes perfect sense. Anybody else's take on a portion of that work, he feels, would have an unwelcome alien effect on the whole of the town mural, as it were. I was disappointed, but the good news was I still had many years' worth of his writing to consume. He also suggested that I write my own story, and take this opportunity to deliver the themes I preferred in his work within my own vehicle. I explained that, of course, this had occurred to me, and perhaps it would even one day come to pass, but my calling has proven to be much more that of storyteller than story writer. Besides, no one can write like him. He writes with the economy of the farmer, which I know he'll understand I mean as a high compliment. The farmer quietly derives his or her pride from an ability to produce the most bountiful yield with the minimum of extravagance. There is nothing superfluous on the ideal farm. There's no need for applied adornment, because on a farm, like a Shaker chair, the beauty lies within the structure, in the care of the farm itself. Mr. Berry has described the Shaker style thus: humble, impersonal, and perfect artistry, which refused the modern divorce of utility and beauty. Through their respective health, the buildings, the land, the animals, and the garden all tell the tale of the farmer's attention, and it's beautiful to see. So read the sentences of Wendell Berry. I can't imagine I'm the first to float the metaphor that his paragraphs have all the neatness of a well-planted field, ideas bursting through the topsoil, yearning toward the sunlight of our gaze with nary a weed in sight. In this day and age, the reading of books has possibly a greater number of easy distractions than ever before. In the ever-present availability of the internet, not to mention our ability to actually watch films and television shows upon the small screen devices we carry in our pockets. I especially love to read writers of serial fiction like J.R.R. Tolkien, Laura Ingalls Wilder, or Patrick O'Brien, who continue to flesh out the world and characters in their stories over a series of books, allowing me to binge upon their work for several episodes, repeatedly forestalling the heartache that invariably descends, if the writing is good, at the end of the final page. I was to discover that the stories and novels of Mr. Berry's Port William membership fall most satisfyingly into that category. Wendell Berry was what you might call a right smart young whippersnapper, growing up on his family's farm between Louisville and Cincinnati, before leaving home to matriculate as a man of letters, first at the University of Kentucky and then at Stanford as a Stegner Fellow, which means he was one of an incandescent group of young revolutionary thinkers collected by Wallace Stegner, impregnable minds to whom he could teach his principles of writing. Ken Kesey, Edward Abbey, Tilly Olson, Ernest Gaines, Robert Stone, and Larry McMurtry rounded out this astonishing, unlikely pool of talent, comprised of writers who produced a disproportionate amount of groundbreaking and incendiary work in their careers. Following up his stint in Alameda, Mr. Berry, newly paired with a fetching young bride named Tanya, traveled to France and Italy on a 1961 Guggenheim Fellowship, where they farmed and kept house together while he continued his studies. After 2 years, they moved back to America, settling in New York City, where, teaching at New York University, Mr. Berry was poised to become one of our nation's brightest literary talents after the publication of his first novel, Nathan Coulter. Everything looked as bright as one might hope, future-wise, but there was just one problem. Wendell was homesick. It was at this juncture that Wendell and Tanya made the decision that would come to shape the rest of their lives together. In 1965, they moved their family back to Kentucky, to the farm upon which Mr. Berry had grown up. He was still fully invested in his vocation of writing. It was just that he wanted to write about the people and the land that he knew most intimately, and those subjects just simply happened to reside on the banks of the Kentucky River in Henry County. On the farm, he cultivated his tobacco crop, even as he planted words in the furrowed minds of his hungry readers, seeds of love that would take root all around the world and bear an ever-increasing yield. I exchanged a few more letters with Mr. Berry over the years, hoping to gently convince him to let me adapt one of his stories, and then eventually I just wanted to go and work with him on his farm. Ever the gentleman, he prudently kept me at arm's length while never hurting my feelings. I continued to read everything he had written, completing his body of fiction and moving on to his essays and finally his poetry. Meanwhile, I had moved to Los Angeles from Chicago, only to discover firsthand how superficial and materialistic so much of the television and film industry were. I suppose I had known this to be the case, but I naively thought that I would remain somehow above the filth of commerce that so permeates the very atmosphere in that town. By saturating myself in his words and identifying with his characters, I was able to maintain a sense of my origins, the hard-working and loving family I had left in Illinois in order to pursue my goal. Even before I got to the plain speak of his essays, I was powerfully moved by the common sense running through his fiction, the grace and reverence with which he described hard work, the people who performed it, and the resultant satisfaction they derived from it, struck a chord within me that rang robust and true. My own father and mother had given me these same lessons and given them well, but the power of Wendell Berry's art reinforced them, bringing them to the forefront of my psyche. Girded by his narrative, I ceased chasing many of the minor paste brass rings that Hollywood dangles, and instead renewed my focus upon my tools and the people in my own fellowship to build myself a foundation upon their love. I want to point out that this is much easier to describe now, with the clarity of 20 years' distance. At the time, I was just following my gut instinct as best I could, navigating through a haze of bourbon, striving to strike gold with the confusing balance of carpenter, actor, country lad, and clown. What I do know is that through all the distracting chatter of popular culture and sour mash medication, I kept steadily reading these stories for the guidance with which they were laced. For the past 15 years, if you've had a conversation with me that ran on longer than 7 sentences, then you've been told about my favorite writer, Wendell Berry, who is this amazing Kentucky agrarian who never quit farming with horses. Thanks to my bottomless yammering, a saintly friend in Austin named Holly Sabiston, if you know her, A, you're lucky, and B, please buy her a cupcake, put me in touch with a pithy young filmmaker and mother of 5 boys named Laura Dunn, who just happened to be making a documentary film about Wendell Berry. Through Laura's generosity and the reported approbation of Mr. Berry's granddaughters for my television show, I was put in touch with Wendell and Tanya's daughter, Mary Berry. I wish that I had saved the initial voicemail Mary left me, but with apologies to her, I will attempt to paraphrase. "Hello, Nick, this is Mary Berry. I have to say, I don't really know who you are, but my girls seem to think you hung the moon, and Laura Dunn is also vouching for you, so give me a call and we'll see if we can get you in to meet Daddy." I'll spare you the girlish delight that flooded my beefy core from that moment through a most illuminating October afternoon visit, and right up until this very recording. It continues yet. Suffice it to say that Wendell and Tanya were as quietly generous with their time and their thoughts as granddaughters Emily Berry and Tanya Smith were with their giggles. I'll only mention that the Berry's son, Den, came through at one point, having just rehung the barn doors, naturally, and he was interested to meet me without any real awareness of my work as a song and dance man. He knew me from an article I had contributed to Fine Woodworking magazine about a shop-made router sled for flattening large slabs of wood. He had constructed and employed the jig to great effect on a book-matched ash slab for an handsome coffee table. I mention this episode because I gratefully feel that my woodworking may have legitimized me far beyond any other qualifications in the eyes of the Berries. Just a hunch. By the way, Laura Dunn's documentary is called 40 Pains, and I came on as a co-producer, which is a fancy way of saying I did a bunch of cheerleading and a bit of fundraising. It's a very moving film about my favorite subject, upon which she did one hell of a nice job while managing 5 boys with her husband Jeff. Wendell and Tanya and I spoke at length about one of his themes that drives me with constancy, that of good work. One aspect of this topic that I often regurgitate is his dislike for a society that celebrates the notion of "thank God it's Friday." Taking this position, people are necessarily saying that they despise 5 of every 7 days of their lives. He said he first noticed it when he was teaching college, that people would answer the question, "How are you doing?" with, "Well, pretty good for a Monday." This exposed a joylessness that filled Mr. Berry with concern. "It's a great harbinger of what's to come. If you don't like the classes about what you're going to do, you're not going to like going to do it." More importantly, he said, "The collegiate system and the importance that's placed upon it has demeaned and is doing away with the trades." This is a topic of his that has always gotten me fired up. When I was in high school in the 80s, only the underachievers and burnouts were relegated to the area of vocational school. It was considered a substantial demotion in life, brought on only by poor grades or